Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Mapping North Carolina's FDI, the challenges of building the base of foreign direct investments in North Carolina and the Triangle. And that's on the front page. The actual article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. State without borders. Is foreign direct investment at risk in the Triangle? This article is written by Angelica Leith. Since the dawning of Research Triangle Park more than five decades ago, the Triangle area has been building its reputation as a global player in industry and trade. Slowly and deliberately, the Tar Heel State has managed to build its foreign direct investments, FDI, base, an economic snapshot that shows the capital investment and jobs created by foreign entities who relocate and expand in the state. In terms of FDI, North Carolina ranks among the top 10 states in the nation when it comes to investments made by foreign companies in manufacturing and manufacturing services. But all those gains may now be under an economic assault whose tentacles reach beyond the boardrooms, government incentives, and availability of skilled labor. In the Triangle alone, the number of foreign projects dropped by half in 2014 after a big increase in 2013. What may be more worrisome is that foreign projects are smaller and require less capital investment, and in most cases, fewer jobs. In 2013, for example, FDI, representing eight countries, announced projects valued at $1.58 billion. By 2014, the capital investment number had dwindled to about $1 billion. Had it not been for two major jobs announcements in the past year, HCL Technologies and Novozymes, some could argue the investment numbers would have been abysmal. So, is the Triangle market becoming unattractive to foreign investors? Or is there a macro-level headwind comprised of the dollar's strength and weakness in Asia, the effect of which is beginning to seep into our economy? Behind the data. Attracting foreign companies to establish major operations in North Carolina or support firms here is a pursuit subject to ebbs and flows. Christopher Chung, Chief Executive Officer of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, says that reported decline of FDI in the past year doesn't necessarily reflect a broader trend. Like anything else, FDI will fluctuate year by year. I think other times it's affected by broader macroeconomic issues, says Chung. The U.S. dollar is an example of a current reflective macro issue. A strong dollar could hurt international economic expansion in the U.S. The stronger the dollar, the less economic attractiveness, Chung notes. It can erode the economic benefit of investment. Chung says that's not to say foreign investors won't invest during the times when the dollar is strong, but the level may drop. The toughest year for the state's FDI followed the Great Recession, impacting the strength of the dollar, which may explain why North Carolina has seen fewer foreign investment projects in the past year. Viability of exporting is another factor. If a company is using the U.S. as a launch point for exporting products, they will also look at the bilateral or multilateral impact of investing. An example of this backfiring can be seen recently with Mexico positioning a stronger, more attractive auto industry with better bilateral trade agreements. If production is cheaper elsewhere, the choice for foreign investors is obvious. Attracting FDI through trade is an international competition among all states, but geographic awareness is a challenge unique to North Carolina. Selling the North Carolina story through analytical and research efforts, data on company growth rates and PR databases that capture companies on the move, helps in the competitive process. A quarter or a third of the business deals that businesses are competing for involve FDI, says Chung. That gives you an idea of how crucial FDI is to state business economic development. John Baugh, director of the North Carolina Japan Center, says attracting FDI involves implementing initiatives that embrace diversity. He says this was a primary challenge and a reason why the center was created. We need to make the area hospitable to Japan and other nations, says Baugh. The cultural differences are so significant that trying to accommodate, understand, and work with that was originally a challenge that the state handled well. Working with Commerce, the Japan Center created programs such as Saturday schools and cultural events. These initiatives played a major role in bringing pharmaceutical companies and automotive industries, Baugh says. Challenges of attracting FDI. Many countries have reservations taking root in individual states. Expanding into global markets involves unique corporate issues, taxation, legal hurdles, immigration obstacles, and cultural differences foreign business people may not have experienced outside of their home countries. Expats' comfort is often a primary concern when foreign businesses choose to expand. The strategy for pushing up foreign investment includes networking and focusing on exports. The North Carolina Department of Commerce maintains offices in Canada, Europe, Hong Kong, Japan, Mexico, and China. In the past year, the department has been pushing to attract more foreign investors, specifically to the Triangle area. In May, a representative was placed in the Korean market. The department is forming a strategy to attract more investment from India as well. Features of the Triangle that rank it so highly as a domestic business destination also are attractive to foreign companies. This is especially true of the state's location on the East Coast, making air and port connections convenient. Foreign investors want cultural comfort knowing they are moving into a sister city relationship with direct international flights and different associations representing countries that exist in North Carolina. There are currently honorary consuls from nearly 24 countries in the state. Adam Monroe, America's president of agricultural biotech giant Novozymes, says part of the attraction of forming a North American headquarters was the prevalence of the biotech market in RTP. Globally headquartered in Denmark, the company's North American headquarters are based in the Triangle. Monroe says that this was a deliberate and strategic decision. There were a lot of competitors and partners that were here before we were, says Monroe. While we are competing, we are also looking to work together. Novozymes moving here did create a buzz in the industry, and it's created even more attention from global competitors. Novozymes originally invested in the Triangle area in 1979 due to available land, the proximity to the larger universities, and technical and innovation resources in the Triangle and the workforce accompanying it. It's always been a good state to do business, says Monroe. One, we've always had a good relationship in the state, historically, and an ease of investments, and it's a great place to innovate, consider new ideas, and partner. It's also a stellar academic community. Monroe notes that the biggest reason that the international company invested in the region was due to Raleigh being home to some of the largest agriculture and biotech companies in the world, presenting a large and thriving community around the specialized science industry. Since founding, Novozymes has invested nearly $300 million into Franklinton alone. In 2014, Novozymes reported two projects in research and development totaling $66.5 million and created 100 jobs in the RTP area as a result. If we meet our ambitions for this new business project, I have no doubt we will continue making new investments in the future, Monroe says. Historically, he says, other global partners and competitors will follow suit. Rajiv Sodhi, Senior Corporate Vice President and Chief Workforce Competitiveness Officer at Indian IT services firm HCL Technologies, also predicts continued investment. Last year alone, the company announced 1,237 jobs would be created in Kerry through foreign investment from India. Sodhi says the company will likely invest another $9 million following this. As we grow, we will continue to invest, says Sodhi. We are on track to invest for the next 5 years. Sodhi also touched on the challenges HCL faced as a global business originally coming to the state. It was a challenge to educate people and make them comfortable with the area, he says. We looked at 5 states and major cities and did an evaluation based on talent pool availability, location, livability, proximity, and weather. Ultimately, North Carolina won. The work we do here propels the business industry with $46 million a year in investment going back to the state's economy, Sodhi says. Over half of our global business at this point is the U.S. Projecting a rise. Although FDI in the Triangle has fluctuated and less projects were reported in 2014, on a state and national level, North Carolina has been moving closer to the rising U.S. percentage of foreign-owned establishments and investments. According to the Global Cities Initiative by Brookings and J.P. Morgan Chase in June 2014, the report found that the nation's largest metro areas contain nearly three-quarters of jobs in international companies. This data includes the Raleigh metro area. Steve Brantley, director of Orange County Economic Development, who previously worked with the State Commerce Department, says the emergence of recruitment possibilities in areas such as China, retooling to focus on international recruitment, also focusing on specialists within markets, is an opportunity that could help boost the area's FDI in the coming years. Brantley stressed that in order to do this, the state needs incentives to attract high-profile international investments through job development investment grants and technical training. In 2014, Brantley helped bring Morinaga America Foods Incorporated, American affiliate of the Japanese candy maker of Hi-Chew Candies, to Orange County through state incentive packages and reimbursed site improvements. It's about taking the next step and increasing investment, he says. This was consistent with Asian investment increasing in the state, and incentives helped. Chung believes the Asian market is a continuing growth opportunity for the state through mergers and acquisitions, such as when Lenovo acquired IBM's RTP-based server division, or when Shanghu acquired Smithfield Foods. That's not an investment in the sense of cutting a ribbon. It's FDI by acquisition, and it's something that isn't widely reported by states because they happen on a different level, says Chung. Nevertheless, it tells the FDI story. It's a story that comes down to a central point, emphasized by Baugh. If North Carolina is going to be a global player, the state needs an industry base supported by global corporations, he says. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. Raleigh Sculptors work sparkles at new Aloft Hotel. Biz joined a small crowd of onlookers gathered in front of NC State University's Bell Tower on Hillsborough Street on August 1 to watch as the construction crane slowly raised the 55-foot stainless steel sculpture called Overtones that will be the architectural centerpiece of the new Aloft Raleigh Hotel. Designed and built by renowned Raleigh sculptor Thomas Sayre, Overtones features a series of both polished and grained stainless steel ovals and triangles overlapping across a singular spine. The piece, Sayre says, is designed to mimic the overtones that are produced from the sound of a bell. The seven-story, 135-room Aloft Raleigh Hotel is scheduled to open to guests September 22nd. EDM visits Ingram's Garage. Looks like one of the newer downtown Raleigh corporate resident. Looks like one of the newer downtown Raleigh corporate resident EDM Americas is busy doing deals and making new friends, but this time it was in Durham. Biz was told EDM America CEO Scott Byers held quite a posh night at the Ingram Collection Garage in Durham recently with about 30 area business executives. The purpose was to make people aware of how automating outsourced back office functions, which is an EDM specialty, such as mail rooms, loan processing, and contract execution, can save companies millions of dollars. Among the interested listeners was former GlaxoSmithKline exec Bob Ingram himself, the owner of the garage turned museum. For those who have not had a chance to visit the garage in Durham, Biz recommends going when invited. The Ingram collection houses some 35 Porsche motors, 911s, 356s, and other Porsche models. It's one of the finest privately owned collections of its type in the world. Sporting news to Crash Davis. Sorry. After 27 years, Sporting News has finally issued an apology to Crash Davis, catcher in the film Bull Durham, for failing to recognize his home run record. The fictional Durham Bulls player was played by Kevin Costner, and fan Annie Savoy was played by Susan Sarandon in the 1988 movie shot at the historic Durham Athletic Park. Today, Crash and Annie are regular characters during in-game entertainment at the Durham Bulls Athletic Park. When Crash hit his 247th home run, I knew the moment it happened, Annie says toward the end of the movie. But I'm sure nobody else did, and the Sportin' News didn't say anything about it. After reporting on August 4th that the existing minor league home run record, Buzz Arlette's 1937 season, was broken by Toledo Mudhens' Mike Hessman, Sporting News finally decided to correct the longtime error. It came to our attention long ago. One of your female fans, Annie S. from North Carolina, was quite vocal that Sporting News neglected to properly recognize you as the all-time minor league home run king when you set the record late in the 1988 season, the apology reads. Better late than never, Crash. Imanji Studios gives Bolt new duds. Raleigh-based Imanji Studios, the developer behind the Temple Run franchise, is dressing Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt, well, at least in the game. Imanji and Bolt have partnered to release a new uniform for his Temple Run 2 character, just in time for the World Championships of Running. The company tells us the new jersey is intended to be a carbon copy of what Bolt will be wearing when he takes the track in Beijing at the end of August, featuring black tiger stripes over his classic green and yellow uniform. Bolt, a six-time Olympic gold medalist, became a Temple Run character in 2013. Performance aside, few things make an athlete feel more confident than his jersey, Bolt says. It's only fitting, then, that my Temple Run 2 alter ego wear the same great jersey I get to wear this summer at the World Championships. And in the section called The Hype, Triangle Cities make headlines in recent national rankings. Number 2, Raleigh is the second best place to live in the U.S., according to WalletHub. Number 9, Chapel Hill is the 9th most educated city of any size in the U.S., according to NerdWallet. And number 10, Raleigh is one of top 10 music cities other than Nashville, according to Music from the Row. And finally, in a You Said It section, reader comments on TBJ Business Pulse poll, which change would hurt your business the most, an increase in the minimum wage or making more workers eligible for overtime? Neither. Small business already knows increasing wages helps their business. That's from Wayne Ernie Jones. Both would hurt our business, from Richard Beckett. Happy, well-cared-for employees make money for me. Unhappy employees do not. Underpay your workers, and you get what you pay for. And that's from K.S. Smith. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. Raleigh's Crabtree Valley Hotel Corridor Revival. Raleigh's Glenwood Avenue and Crabtree Valley Corridor hasn't seen this much hospitality action in decades. Speculation is beginning to build that the new owners of the former Soleil Center tower site at Creedmoor Road are in talks again with Starwood Hotel and Resorts to build a new luxury hotel property on the site. The land was previously the site of a 12-story Sheraton Hotel until the building was demolished in 2006 to make way for the proposed 43-story Soleil Center Tower that would be anchored by a Westin-branded hotel. Vertical construction of the building, however, was scuttled when the previous developers were forced into foreclosure due to the recession. Other hotel property owners along the corridor also seem to be spiffing up in anticipation of the new competition and to better meet demand of visitors coming to the area. The new owners of the 12-story Holiday Inn Hotel at the busy intersection of Glenwood Avenue and the I-440 Beltline in Raleigh are nearing the midway point of a nearly $8 million renovation of the 40-year-old property. Marriott Crabtree Hotel is undergoing a major renovation and expansion. A new Hampton Inn and Suites Hotel opened in 2013. And its sister property, a Hilton Garden Inn, developed and managed by Wynwood Hospitality of Raleigh, opened to guests August 3rd. There are also six other hotel properties within a mile of the Crabtree Valley Mall property, including an Embassy Suites, Courtyard by Marriott, and La Quinta Inn and Suites. Manish Atma, president of Atma Hotel Group of Chapel Hill and owner of the Holiday Inn Raleigh Crabtree Valley Mall Hotel, says the renovations of his property were necessary to meet market demands. "We had to make the changes," Atma says of his Holiday Inn property, which is among the most visible of all the hotel locations at the base of the exit ramp from I-440. "It's a great location, a great building. It just needed some TLC." And in a section called Deals of the Week, Buying and Selling, retail developer makes $21 million offer for land near Cary Town Center Mall. South Carolina-based Columbia Development Group has offered to pay North Carolina $21.1 million for a 95-acre property on Cary Town Boulevard in Cary that's been owned by the state since the 1930s. The property, located near both Cary Town Center Mall and the Wake Med Soccer Park and Stadium, had been deemed surplus property by the state several years ago, but earlier offers to buy the property never came to fruition. Company president Edward Bud Mann says his team has not yet submitted a site plan or rezoning request to the town with details of what commercial or residential development could be built on the property. Dillwig pays $16 million for distressed North Raleigh office buildings. Durham commercial real estate investment firm the Dillwig Companies has acquired two prominent office buildings on Falls of Neuse Road in North Raleigh that have been fighting foreclosure proceedings from its lenders for years. Dillwig, on July 31, paid $15.9 million for the six-story Somerset Center and four-story Somerset Place office building in the 4500 block of Falls of Neuse Road. The investment firm plans to also spend $3.5 million in capital improvements to the buildings. Meritage Homes pays $20 million for a brickyard property in Cary. Durham-based Triangle Brick Company and two of its neighbors owning property at the Cary intersection of I-540 and NC-55 have sold their assemblage of 100 acres of land for $20 million to Arizona-based home building company Meritage Homes. The company has been approved for construction of 304 townhomes, 126 detached dwellings, and a private amenity center project, according to Cary Town Records. And finally, a spotlight on Durham. Tracking vacancy rates in Central Durham. The Central Durham office submarket, which includes all of the downtown Durham district and several outlier properties, has the lowest Class A office vacancy rate among all the major office submarkets in the Triangle region. And it's been that way for a while, according to TBJ's quarterly space survey, which tracks rentable space vacancy reports of commercial buildings of 10,000 square feet or more. In the second quarter 2015, one company vacated a small 6,000-square-foot office space in the Washington Building at the American Tobacco Campus, and for now it's the only space available for lease among the more than 960,000 square feet of new and redeveloped office building space at ATC. And now we turn to the On Healthcare page written by Jason DeBruin. The first headline, Leadership Shakeup at DHHS. On August 5, Governor Pat McCrory threw the state's public health care world into a tizzy when he announced that Dr. Aldana Vuce, the Secretary of North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, would step down. Rick Breyer, a business executive whose companies have had a checkered history, will take over, effective August 17. In early reflections on her tenure that lasted less than 3 years, observers will likely remember Vuce more for her critics than her backers, though one analyst says that her stepping down might lead to a pact on Medicaid reform. Breyer, her replacement, comes with several question marks. He most recently led ProNerve, a health services company based in Denver, Colorado. On April 14, that company was acquired out of bankruptcy by Specialty Care based in Nashville, Tennessee. The majority of his recent career was spent with LipoScience, a Raleigh-based diagnostics company that held high promise but ultimately failed to convince health insurance companies to pay for its diagnostic tool. Breyer left the company in 2013, a decade after he joined. In October 2014, LipoScience was acquired by Burlington-based Laboratory Corporation of America. In both cases, Breyer left the company before it was acquired. Before LipoScience, Breyer held various senior management positions at Becton Dickinson, or BD, a medical technology company. After receiving a degree in chemical engineering from Purdue University and an MBA from Stanford University, he began his career as a product development engineer at the Procter & Gamble Company. In the announcement, McCrory gave few details about Breyer's qualifications, saying only, "Rick Breyer brings a unique set of experience and skills to DHHS. His background in healthcare and in business is the perfect fit for the department and the work that lies ahead." While Vuce received criticisms nearly throughout her tenure, the issues weren't all of her own doing. Medicaid easily takes the crown as the most debated topic that affected the department during Vuce's tenure. Those debates, however, started as far away as the White House with the Affordable Care Act and took center stage in North Carolina on Jones Street as lawmakers bat several reform plans around. More than 1 year after she introduced the Medicaid reform plan, lawmakers still had not passed it. Secretary Wu should get credit for doing an about-face and recognizing that we need to build on our existing program and even expand coverage to 500,000 more people, says Adam Linker, a health policy analyst at the North Carolina Justice Center, a Raleigh liberal policy advocacy group. Unfortunately, her leadership style caused friction with the legislature and in the department, which ultimately made reform and expansion difficult. Linker adds that her resignation could clear the way for a legislative deal on Medicaid reform. Vuce drew some of the loudest criticism from doctors when DHHS switched to a new software system called NCTRAX to manage Medicaid claims. For months, healthcare providers had trouble filing claims properly, something that delayed payments and threatened to put some small providers out of business. Some providers filed a lawsuit against DHHS. More recently, however, most of those troubles with NCTRAX have been worked out. Nicole Emanuel represented the doctors while she worked with the law firm Williams Mullen. She has since become a partner with the law firm Gordon Rees and blogs regularly about healthcare issues and has been critical of DHHS in several posts. Vuce is charged with the challenging task of managing one of our largest and most expensive agencies. It would be difficult for anyone, regardless their background, she wrote in an email following McCrory's announcement. However, I would want any secretary of DHHS to have knowledge of or to find out more of the trials and turmoil of actual Medicaid recipients and providers. Trial enrollment triggers Chimerix's stock spike. Shares of Durham-based drug developer Chimerix Incorporated touched an all-time high on August 3, partly on news that the company completed enrollment on a trial testing of its drug against adenovirus infection in immunocompromised patients. The trial, titled Phase 3 Advise, which tests the Chimerix drug brincidofovir, targeted 200 patients. It began enrolling in March 2014 with no approved treatment for adenovirus. Short-term mortality rates have been reported as high as 80% in patients with disseminated disease, according to Chimerix. Earlier this year, Chimerix reported preliminary results from the initial 85 patients enrolled in ADVISE and treated with brincidofovir. Results showed a mortality rate of less than 40% for bone marrow transplant recipients with disseminated adenovirus disease and for the patient population. And now we have a section called Big Numbers. 125. The number of former GlaxoSmithKline employees who will receive their second pink slip in less than a year when pharmaceutical research organization Parexel International Corporation lays off 125 workers in the Triangle. Late last year, GlaxoSmithKline announced a major restructuring that would result in a reduction of 900 positions from the drug maker. The silver lining, however, was that Parexel would hire as many as 500 of those workers as a sort of GSK subunit to take over some of the ongoing GSK research. A Parexel spokeswoman confirmed this latest round of layoffs will affect the Research Triangle Park Sanders Building location, the planned home for those GSK workers. Layoffs will happen over a 14-day period beginning September 30th. 130. The number of workers GSK will hire in Zebulon as it ramps up production of respiratory medicines at the manufacturing facility there. As giant companies, both Parexel and GSK have many different job functions, and the type of workers GSK wants to hire in Zebulon are different from the types laid off in Research Triangle Park. $20 million. Drug developer Osera Therapeutics Incorporated could borrow up to $20 million, extending the company's cash runway into at least mid-2017. Osera is the former TransZyme Pharma. Company management is headquartered in Palo Alto, California, but research and development happens in RTP. The company wants to develop a treatment for acute and chronic patients with hepatic encephalopathy, a worsening of brain function due to liver trouble. And finally, we have a section called Stock Corner. In the past week, major shareholders of two Triangle-based pharmaceutical research companies announced their intention to sell some of their holdings. 9 months after going public, a group of major shareholders of Inc. Research planned to sell off a block of 8 million shares. Also, major shareholders at Quintile said they would do the same by selling 7 million shares. Both companies contract with pharmaceutical companies to test and develop experimental new drugs. And now we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onasorge. The first headline, HCL ahead of hiring schedule for 1,237 at flagship hub in Cary. With more than 2 years to go, Indian IT services firm HCL Technologies is ahead of schedule in hiring the 1,237 people it pledged to add to its Cary operation. Last September, HCL said it would expand its 815-person local headcount by the end of 2018 in exchange for more than $9 million in state incentives. The growing Cary campus, one of more than 34 global HCL locations, is, quote, absolutely a cornerstone, unquote, in the company's overall strategy, says Matt Preshern, Chief Marketing Officer of the global technology firm. Speaking after an earnings report fueled by both the U.S. and European markets, he says that the company is 490 jobs into that promise. The company already had 815 at its Cary facility and has since expanded into a second building. I would suggest it's one of our flagship hubs in the U.S., he says, a fact given more oomph over the past year as a new operation opened in Texas. Earlier this year, HCL decided to invest in two key areas, digitalization and the Internet of Things, the name given to a tech reality where information can travel easily over a network between objects and people without direct human-to-human or even human-to-computer interaction. Some of the Cary jobs are specifically targeted for specialization in those areas, he says. Can this NCSU-developed cigarette case guilt smokers into quitting? It's a cigarette case that counts every cigarette you smoke. and thanks to a proprietary software platform, it can share that data with your support group. It's NicoTrax, a technology developed by a pair of recent NC State University graduates. Kyle Linton, CEO of NicoTrax, says the firm is getting funded. It has already closed on more than $15,000 and is currently in the middle of a $100,000 raise, having obtained backing from the likes of local angel investor Alex Osadzinski, formerly of Trinity Ventures. It's the concept that is selling the pitch, he explains, a concept that deploys engineering principles to do what support groups alone can't always tackle. We're trying to make users more cognizant of their habits, Linton explains. Just like a Fitbit that tracks your steps, the NicoTrax device keeps track of the times you go for that cigarette case, reminding users via their own smartphones of their quit goals when it's most needed. Among its tactics, flashing the photo of a loved one with an encouraging message in your time of weakness. The goal is to help users understand their own habits better, to develop a better understanding of what factors are influencing their smoking behaviors. Suraj Doshi, Chief Technology Officer, co-founded the technology, which was developed as part of an NC State problem-solving assignment. Osadzinski says, while he was sold on the impressive team, the concept makes sense and solves a big problem. I like companies that try to make the world a better place for everyone, he says. Reducing smoking is good for everyone. The company has teamed up with Raleigh-based app developer Lithios to fine-tune the software product, and with a manufacturer from India to mass produce the prototype. And in a section by the numbers, July layoffs in North Carolina lower than in previous years. Layoffs hit North Carolina during the month of July, but came with far fewer pink slips than in 2014, according to data reported to the North Carolina Department of Commerce. But the numbers are somewhat deceptive, as they come from WARN filings, which allow some cuts to fall through the cracks. When closing plants and laying off at least 500 employees, or between 50 and 499, if they make up at least one-third of the employer's workforce, companies are required to file a worker adjustment and retraining notification, WARN. But if a company with a massive headcount lays off fewer than 500 people, no such report needs to be filed. In July 2015, three companies reported cuts to their headcounts: Philips Optimum, URS, and Schenker. And in a section called He Said It, some projects did go elsewhere or find another state to film in. And that quote is from Guy Gaster, director of the North Carolina Film Office, discussing the challenges in recruiting production companies for the $4 million grant reserve the state has left to incentivize film projects in the state. The windfall came about when an approved project, a Dirty Dancing remake in Western North Carolina, pulled the plug on production. And now we turn to the On Transportation page, written by Jeff Jeffrey. The first headline: American U.S. Airways poised to merge at RDU. Next week, RDU will begin shifting ticket counters in Terminal 2 to allow American and U.S. Airways to begin operating side by side. Overnight on August 10, RDU will move U.S. Airways next to American's ticket counter. Then, overnight on August 12, Delta Airlines and United Airlines will swap ticketing locations. RDU spokesman Andrew Sawyer says the latter shift was necessary to keep the baggage volume roughly the same throughout the airport's baggage screening system. The U.S. Airways Club already merged with the American Airlines Admirals Club last year. American will allow U.S. Airways to maintain its branding and signage through October 17. Sawyer says that night all the signs will switch to American's logo. Business travelers who fly every day may notice that they have to turn in the other direction to get where they're going, Sawyer says, but it should be fairly unnoticeable for everyone else. American Airlines has brought back its curbside check-in process at RDU. Starting August 3, Delta's curbside check-in facility will scoot down the curb to accommodate American's facility, Sawyer says. The next phase of RDU's move to consolidate its American and U.S. Airways facilities will take place next year, when the airport moves to co-locate the American Airlines U.S. Airways gates. Until then, American Airlines flights will operate from both Concourse C and Concourse D in Terminal 2. Wake riders want more frequent transit. Wake County residents appear to prefer a transportation plan that emphasizes more frequent transit options, but less clear is how much demand there is for building a costly rapid rail line versus improving the country's bus fleet. County transportation officials have held more than 150 community meetings and met with hundreds of residents to get feedback on four proposals for what transit in the county could look like within the next decade. Tim Gardner of Wake County's Planning Department says so far there has been a clear preference for improving the frequency of transit options in key areas rather than focusing on expanding the transit system's coverage of the county. If that approach is adopted, the goal would be to get frequency down to every 15 minutes in high traffic areas. That doesn't mean we would abandon areas that are farther out, he says, but it shows that people understand there are trade-offs and frequency is more important to the rest of the network. The results have been more mixed when it comes to the mode of transit. So far, responses have shown that adding a rail line is important to a sizable portion of the community, but equally important to respondents is improving the bus transit system. When we draft a final proposal, we'll have to figure out how to work with that balance, Gardner says. Getting an idea of where the community stands is important, Gardner says, because the final plan will have to factor in the cost of various proposals. The county intends to seek federal and state money to help fund the project. If it includes rail, the project would likely cost $1.1 billion. The county would seek federal funding to cover 21% of that amount. A rapid transit bus system would cost $500 million, with the county seeking federal dollars to cover 35% of the total. Teresa Gresham, a member of the Kimley Horn team working with the county to develop a final transit plan, says the results seen so far could still change as the county hears back from more residents. We're encouraging people to reach out to the county to make sure their perspective is included, Gresham says. And in a section titled Energy, North Carolina Eastern Municipal Power Agency finalized the sale of its power generation assets to Duke Energy Progress. $1.25 billion, amount Duke paid for the power facilities. 700, generating capacity in megawatts represented by NCEMPA's ownership interest in the power facilities. $421 million, NCEMPA's debt following the transaction. The wholesale power provider's 32 member cities will pay the debt off over the next 10 years. And 19%. Average amount the deal is expected to save NCEMPA's municipal customers. The agency's members will then pass those savings along to their customers. And now we turn to the A Better World page in the Triangle Business Journal, written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. The headline on his column, Tiny Homes to Shelter the Homeless. Among the nearly 359,000 adults in North Carolina who live with serious mental illness, or nearly 1 in 20 adult North Carolinians, fewer than half receive treatment and only 1 in 3 receive services from the state's public mental health system. North Carolinians diagnosed with mental illness also account for roughly 1 in 4 of the nearly 9,000 adults in the state who are homeless. Providing a place to live and support services for people with mental illness is the goal of a partnership that aims to begin building a small community of 200-square-foot tiny homes on a farm in Chatham County. The homes represent, quote, a potential solution to the life of chronic homelessness and isolation experienced by a majority of our clients, unquote, says Rebecca Sorensen, a volunteer and former intern at The Farm at Penny Lane, a program of the Center for Excellence in Community Mental Health at the School of Medicine at the UNC Chapel Hill. The Tiny Home Collaborative is the brainchild of Sorensen and Thava Mahadevan, Director of Operations at the center. As one of five semifinalists competing for a $25,000 grant from Triangle Community Foundation to support partnerships to address community problems, the Tiny Home Collaborative received $7,000. Mahadevan, who also is founder and volunteer executive director of XDS Incorporated, a nonprofit that owns the farm at Penny Lane and leases it to the center, says it will use some of the grant to study local zoning rules and the remainder as matching funds to help raise the roughly $30,000 needed to build a demonstration tiny home. The home would serve as a model dwelling for mentally ill individuals who would stay for a week or two. The partnership would work with Habitat for Humanity of Chatham County to build an initial cluster of three tiny homes at the farm for local residents with mental illness. The 40-acre farm includes an acre used to grow vegetables and produce honey and eggs that are donated to patients with mental illness at the center's outpatient clinic at Carr Mill Mall in Carrboro and sold at the Farrington Farmers Market and the Farmers Market at UNC Hospitals. The farm also houses offices for a team that serves 110 people, mainly in Chatham and Orange counties, with serious disabilities and mental illness, and it provides center patients with horticultural therapy and with therapy that involves training dogs for adoption and socializing puppies trained to be service dogs for military veterans. It also plans to add therapeutic programs involving music, art, and yoga. In partnership with Chatham County Habitat for Humanity, Tiny Homes plans at the Chatham County Fair in September to build a demonstration home for the farm at Penny Lane. Sorensen says the tiny homes will mean increased self-sufficiency and improved quality of life for people diagnosed with mental illness. And in nonprofit news, Biogen donates $20,000 to education agency. Biogen, North Carolina's largest biotechnology company, celebrated its 20th anniversary in Research Triangle Park with a $20,000 donation to the Center for Inquiry-Based Learning, a Durham science education nonprofit. CIBL provides professional development and hands-on science STEM curricula and materials for North Carolina K-8 classrooms. The donation will allow CIBL to have an impact on every elementary and middle school in Durham Public Schools. Bayer Crop Science hosts STEM Camp. Bayer Crop Science hosted Passage Home Summer Camp for Making Science Make Sense experiments at its headquarters in RTP. Bayer's science education program will give fifth graders hands-on STEM skills through various experiments covering pollination, molecules, chemical reactions, and more. Bayer Crop Science has donated a grant of $600,000 in order to help its missions break the cycle of poverty. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the business profile that's on Gonza Tacos and Tequila. The headline, "The Little Restaurant That Could." Started with a handful of cash, Gonza Tacos has grown to four sites and $6 million. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle. This fall, one of Raleigh's fastest-growing Latin-style restaurants, Gonza Tacos and Tequila, Eat Tequila, will open its fourth location inside the new Aloft Raleigh Hotel on Hillsborough Street, one of the restaurant group's most ambitious and expensive endeavors yet. Well, it's expensive by the standards of Gonza's co-founders, cousins Gonza Salamanca and Carlos Rodriguez, who admit that they bluffed their way into opening their first restaurant when that one opened in an aging North Raleigh shopping center in 2011. "It was a struggle to get it going. There was no money and no financials," Salamanca says now about the first Gonza's in the Greystone Shopping Center on Lead Mine Road. Who's going to give you a place when you have no money? Nobody. When he submitted his lease application for a newly vacated restaurant space next to the Food Lion, the landlord questioned whether there was a mistake when he put down $30,000 as his amount of capital to get started. Salamanca didn't make a correction when the number was changed to $300,000. We didn't have $300,000. We didn't even have the $30,000, he says. What they had was $10,000 from Rodriguez's savings while working for various restaurant chains in the Washington, D.C. area, enough to cover their deposit. The previous restaurant in the space, which had closed after less than a year, had left behind most of its kitchen equipment, tables, and chairs. Family members and friends donated their time to get the restaurant ready. Salamanca took a page from another popular Raleigh Latin restaurant, Dos Taquitos, owned by his brother, Carlos Salamanca, incorporating a colorful, eclectic mix of artwork and repurposed decorations, and pushed the Colombian and Latin American accents even further over the top. There's a crime scene tape outline of a man at the front door. On weekends, the restaurants bring in human mannequins, artists trained to remain still for extended lengths of time to entertain and shock its guests. In its first 2 weeks in business, Salamanca says word had spread about the new Mexican restaurant that had opened, and sales were enough to make the restaurant staff's first payroll. We didn't know people were looking for a place like this, but they were, Salamanca says. They liked it, and they came back. Since then, Gonza has made a growing business out of moving into dead restaurant spaces where other operators couldn't make it work. In 2013, Salamanca and Rodriguez were approached by the owners of The Factory in Wake Forest about opening a Gonza's there in a space where four other restaurant operators had already tried and failed. Same thing. A lot of the fit-up and equipment was already there, Salamanca says, and the restaurant has been self-sustaining since it opened in late 2013. Last February, Gonza's opened its first restaurant in Durham, taking a space at West Village where, again, a couple of other restaurant concepts had already tried and closed. The new Aloft Raleigh Hotel in Hillsborough Street, though, will be Gonza's first ground-up restaurant location, meaning they'll have to pick out their own kitchen and dining room equipment without having to rely on the leftovers of others. Neither Salamanca nor Rodriguez would disclose the total cost of the upfit of the space in the new building, opening September 22, because they say the developers of the hotel have agreed to front much of the restaurant's construction cost. It's been good. Every single restaurant has opened with very little money, and from day one, it pays its bills, pays its debt, Salamanca says. That's almost unheard of in the restaurant industry. I now will turn to the small business section in the Triangle Business Journal, to the column written by Jim Verdonik, who is an attorney at Warden Smith, PA in Raleigh. The headline, Lessons from the World's Smartest Entrepreneur. I've been legal advisor to hundreds of entrepreneurs, talked with hundreds more, and been writing about entrepreneurs for this newspaper for 17 years. Recently, someone asked me to tell them about the smartest entrepreneur I've ever met. You would think that with so many candidates it might be difficult to pick one, but surprisingly, one entrepreneur immediately came to mind. One of my volunteer activities is teaching business law to high school students who are preparing for a business plan competition. It's a great program, but it's a lot of work for the students. Why do they bother? Wondering what motivated these high school students, I began class by asking students why they had entered this competition. Most of the class gave different versions of the same answer. Their parents wanted, i.e. forced, them to do it. It would look good on their college applications. But my candidate for World's Smartest Entrepreneur answered my question more thoughtfully when she said, I'm not doing this to start the next Google or Apple. I want to be an artist, and I think that if I learn how to be an entrepreneur, I'll be better able to control what I do as an artist instead of other people telling me what to do. Wow. How did an 18-year-old girl get so smart when she is so young? Imagine how great the world would be if everyone understood how the world works like this young artist entrepreneur. In a few words, she managed to tell me she intended to control her own life by learning how the world works, define why most entrepreneurs choose to start businesses, break stereotypes that entrepreneurs are mainly motivated by money, recognize that money is a useful tool even for artists, set an example for how other creative people can make their way in the world, show how entrepreneurs are different from other business people, managers, and administrators. For people who might be surprised about artists being entrepreneurial, let's focus on common characteristics that most entrepreneurs have. Most entrepreneurs are dissatisfied with the way something is being done. Most entrepreneurs have a vision of a better future. Most entrepreneurs are willing to take risks to achieve that vision. Doesn't that sound a lot like an artist? Of course, not all artists are successful. When we look at those who are successful, we find that they share other characteristics of successful entrepreneurs: inquiring minds, discipline, persistence, ability to persuade others to see their vision and support it. When you look at entrepreneurs and artists through the same prism, you begin to see the world in a new light. Of course, artists and entrepreneurs don't just share good qualities. Everyone is imperfect. Many artists and entrepreneurs share the same imperfections: impatience with people who don't share their vision, boredom with implementation and repetition, above average egos, a restlessness that quickly drives them away from the comfort of success to explore the wilderness of new ideas, anxiety that they are not as creative or as innovative as everyone thinks they are. They fear that their last work of art or innovation will be their last. Understand both these weaknesses and strengths if you want to get along with either artists or entrepreneurs. Here's a question. What do you think that 18-year-old aspiring artist entrepreneur is doing now, several years later? And finally, we have a section in the Triangle Business Journal headlined Bear Biz, Bear Industries Total Economic Output by State. And it's a top 15 list. At the top of the list is California, $32.8 billion, Texas, $19.2 billion, New York, $15.3 billion, but coming in at number 12, North Carolina, $7.8 billion. And we're going to stop there because we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.